Welcome to the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast, where educators go to find inspiration and learn world-class strategies from top leaders across the globe. Better Leaders, Better Schools was created by Danny Sunshine Bauer.
This is episode number 146 with Stephanie Frank. Hi there, my name is Danny Sunshine Bauer. I'm a former classroom teacher and school administrator turned life and leadership coach. I'm also the host of this podcast where each week I share my conversation with top leaders from across the globe to help you accelerate your leadership development. In today's show with Stephanie, we explore a number of interesting topics like don't let people feel broken, the survival of the busiest in our mind, the polyvagal theory, and Stephen Porges. What? I had no idea what that was either. And connection is the key to success with students and staff. You're going to love this episode with Stephanie. I sure did. She dug into the science behind why relationships, why mindset, why mindfulness. I mean, all this stuff. This is a true treat for the Better Leaders, Better Schools listener today. So thanks for spending some time with me listening to this podcast. I hope you enjoy this show. One thing I do want to mention is there is a downloadable checklist, that elevator activity that Stephanie describes later on in the episode. If you want to be able to print that out and follow along and practice that visualization technique each day, that's available on the blog. So just click the link through the show notes. Now we're going to jump into the episode, and I'd like to take some time to thank our show sponsors. A lot of school leaders talk about improving students' soft skills to help them succeed in their rigorous coursework. The problem is that most leaders just talk about it without actually doing anything. You can improve your students' non-cognitive skills today by checking out an amazing program called Organized Binder. Learn more at organizedbinder.com. Well, hey there, Better Leaders. I am excited to talk with Stephanie Frank today. Her expertise is going to be really applicable, super useful for school leaders, and just so honored to have her on the show. Stephanie's graduate degree from New York University and fieldwork at the NYU Phelps Lab for Neuroscience Research, NYU Institute for Prevention Science, and Yeshiva University's Albert Einstein College of Medicine focused on the cross-section of neuroscience, resilience, and social justice. She combines a decade plus of counseling and teaching in schools and organizations across the U.S., Canada, Europe, Latin America, and Africa with insights gained from science research and training in monasteries with meditation and mindfulness teachers from Africa, U.S., Vietnam, and India. She now offers neuroscience workshops and consulting to universities and businesses such as Illinois State University, City Colleges of Chicago, the Chicago Teachers Union, Northwestern University's School of Education and Social Policy, Google, HPI Design School in Berlin, and school districts throughout the US, UK, and Canada. Stephanie, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm really glad to be here.
So the bio is a mouthful because there's a lot of really interesting work that you do. I'm curious, where does it start when you get this cross-section of neuroscience, resilience, and social justice?
Yeah.
And then we talk about training in monasteries and meditation. Tell us who you are, because this is fascinating, Stephanie.
Thank you. Well, I'll just say quickly too that, you know, I think some of it came from my dad. He was born in Germany, was set up to work at Mercedes-Benz, but didn't want to do that. Turned around and went to South Africa to become a welder, then took a fishing boat and hitchhiked on multiple boats to get all the way around Africa to Rio and hitchhiked his way up to Canada. So I definitely got a lot of that kind of random curveball journey from him. So I've always worked with young people and have always been fascinated by learning, but a few experiences, one in particular, really kind of set some of the rest of this into motion. And that was, I worked with high school students, well, they were high school graduates, and they were having some difficulties in traditional classrooms. And so I worked for this organization where we took them to Latin America, Guatemala, Honduras, Costa Rica, and they did service work there. They worked, did hurricane relief and worked in orphanages. And the thing that I saw when I was working with these students was that a couple of things. So a really great quote that I love from these MIT psychologists, I'm not going to remember their names right now, but it's, most of what we do is what we do most of the time. And that is that we seem to have these like repetitive patterns of behaviors that keep us stuck. And I saw that these students that I was working with had these stories about themselves that were being told kind of just through their experiences from the past. So one student in particular, I'm going to call him David. He, you know, had a fairly rough past, you know, alcoholic father, a lot of physical abuse in the family. And he was going down, you know, a trajectory of kind of getting involved in gangs and drugs and stuff like that. But then when we got there, so we did some one-on-one counseling and that was part of this. But the other piece I saw was that he was needed by the community and the community just saw a strength in him and asked him to help. And just feeling that sense of, you know, value that he had to contribute to the world. It's like something shifted him in him. And then the other piece that came in was while I was talking to him without realizing it, and it's something he told me later and he wrote a letter to me later to tell me to keep doing this, was that I didn't let him feel like he was broken. And so there was this shift and I saw it in multiple, probably I would say out of the 15 students, I saw like a profound shift in at least 8 of them of how they saw themselves. And then I saw later, because I still know them years and almost over a decade later, they've done amazing things with their life. So what I realized, what I wanted to figure out was, first of all, how do we form this idea of who we are? Like, how does this story happen? And then how does that shift happen? Like, can we have an aha moment that changes their life? And can we as teachers or mentors or counselors, can we help spark that aha moment? And so that brought me back to, you know, and I played around with a lot of different fields of what I was going to study, but I got drawn to NYU and specifically neuroscience because I felt like there was something about the mind and the brain and how we could change it, which was another thing I was learning about at the time, that could kind of help me figure some of that out. So I went to NYU and I really wanted to focus on this idea of neuroplasticity and something specific called self-directed neuroplasticity, which is our ability to use our mind and mental forces to actually alter the wiring of our physical brain, which is something introduced by someone called Jeffrey M. Schwartz. And when I got there, so 2 things happened. One was to kind of help pay for a lot of stuff, I nannied a lot. I nannied for so many different families. Number 2, I ended up getting mentored by a teacher who was really into meditation and mindfulness and studying the effects on the brain. And actually, number 3 was I also got involved in working with students in low socioeconomic neighborhoods in the Bronx and Brooklyn. So kind of this combination of 3 different environments and experiences got me to see a few things. And one was that I noticed that children's behavior changed depending on which adult was in the room. Mm-hmm. So that was a really big aha moment for me. I would just see almost personalities and behaviors transform depending on who it was. So I wanted to look at that. And then also just noticing that the adults way of seeing the child affected how they treated the child. So if an adult was seeing the child as just being a jerk and that tantrum they're throwing is my kid, that kid just, you know, being trying to do this on purpose, trying to upset me on purpose, versus an adult who saw a child throwing a tantrum and saying, I think that child's overwhelmed by whatever is happening.
Right.
The way the adult saw the child really transformed their interactions with the kid. And so yeah, so that kind of all like fused together. And so I ended up like that professor got me to reflect a lot in my own life and how my childhood had affected the stories I told about myself and all the patterns I saw in my relationships. And so that got led me to kind of go to monasteries and work a lot in meditation and visualization. So it all kind of just fused together.
It's fascinating, you know, and those stories that you tell yourself, I guess the worldview that gets built from there.
Yeah.
You know, how you see the world, how you see yourself, and how that led to, you know, just a different type of work that you engaged in.
Yeah.
I'm so looking forward to this interview to hear more and more and more. I have personal experiences, you know, that I want to connect. Like a lot of that seems like expectations, you know, and you get almost what you expect.
Yes.
And I forget the quote, like energy goes where the focus flows or something like that. But, you know, when you put your energy behind something, when you say this is the goal I'm trying to work toward, then you're probably going to make that happen. You're going to find habits. You're going to participate in activities to move in that direction.
Yep.
Same things with people, like, you know, with students or whatever. You see them as a dirty, rotten scoundrel.
you're probably going to try to focus on, okay, I caught them cheating on the test or whatever. I mean, honestly, as an administrator, I had a supervisor that I'm sure just thought I was so terrible. Mm-hmm. She made my staff feel uncomfortable because she kept like really trying to sneak up and find things I was doing wrong.
Yeah.
Like, who's supposed to be at this post at what time? And what, why aren't they there? And like, what? And I had staff members come like, what's this person's deal? Like, they are crazy. I said, oh, they don't like me. So they're looking for everything that I do wrong. But then it really was very frustrating and was very painful. Mm-hmm. And thank God for the community to get me through that time. But when somebody only sees the negatives and they don't see the positive that you bring, like, man, does that stink, because you feel trapped.
Yep.
So this is me as an adult, as a leader of a building. Mm-hmm. Imagine when you don't have, I guess, the authority that I have, or the power, or just even the maturity of being an adult, and you're a kid and you're the teacher or the school leader and you're putting that on them. Imagine what that causes. And so is that a bit like what you were seeing when those behaviors changed based on the adult that's in the room? Or
yes, absolutely. I think that that word expectation is really, really, really important. And we learn expectations. We're not born with expectations. It all comes from our experiences. And interestingly, actually, there's, I believe it's Yale, released a study a little while ago. I'm sure some of the listeners have heard of it, where they studied, we're now able to gaze, track eye gaze. So we can set up, and where our eyes focus, just like you were saying, energy goes where focus goes, or something like that.
Yeah, where the focus flows.
Yeah. So where our eyes focus tends to be what we are looking for. And so when our eyes gaze at something, it's often because we expect, there's something we are expecting. And what they saw was they did this study and they took teachers from different races and they had four, I think it was preschoolers, in a video excerpt. And so there was a black boy, a white boy, a black girl, and a white girl in this video. And it was specifically chosen because there was no quote unquote bad behavior. There was nothing amiss in this. They were all playing very normally, but the teachers were prompted to push the enter button every time they saw what they considered to be bad behavior, misbehavior. And the interesting thing was that over 40% of the eye gaze of all four teachers was focused on the black boy. And the two girls, I think, got 10 and 11% of the teacher's gaze. And the white boy got, I think, 25%.
Mm.
So the teachers were looking, and they also pushed the enter button a significantly higher time for the boy. So what they were looking for, and they, because they've been prompted by different cues from our society of who might fall into the bad misbehaving category, who not. So, and the interesting thing is that expectations, and this is something a lot from Carol Dweck's research on growth mindset, there's a lot of research that shows that teachers that make it very clear what their expectations are of certain students, those students will respond to those expectations, whether they're high or low. So your experience is like, you know, in the adult world, but exactly if it's happening for a child, the thing that I think I'm trying to express in a lot of my work is that so much of our behavior today now is learned, and learning comes from repeated exposure to something. Mm-hmm. And the younger we are when we get exposed to different things, like someone's low expectations of us, the more likely that will become something called a myelinated pathway, which is when we have a thought enough times and we receive stimulus enough times, the brain actually devotes really expensive material to coat the pathways, to cover these pathways with this white fat that makes it a autopilot, uninterruptible pathway. And that person will then, that will be kind of a default way of thinking for them and seeing themselves. So those stories and beliefs that we, that get created, and oftentimes when we're young, because our brains are still kind of specializing and haven't decided which networks we're going to hang on to. In neuroscience, we call it survival of the busiest. Whichever networks are kept busy in the brain survive. When that happens is when we're young and people are repeating messages to us and we're getting it from all different angles, those networks in the brain actually become myelinated. They become autopilot and they sink into our subconscious. That's when it becomes subconscious. And we don't even realize that we are, those beliefs are running in the background for every scenario that we then come into. Right. And the good news is that it's always survival of the busiest. So when a teacher, like the beautiful research too says, like resilience research from Harvard Center for Developing Child, the presence of just one adult with high expectations of a child can change the trajectory of a child. It only takes the presence of one adult or caregiver. And it doesn't matter how traumatic the experience of that child was, if that one adult can appear in that child's life, it can change the wiring, architecture, and trajectory of that child's brain.
Yeah, because part of what you're sharing that's at least a little bit scary is like if it's running in the background because it's survival of the busiest, it almost becomes your default operating system in terms of your brain.
Exactly. Yes.
But what I'm hearing you say, kind of, I'm reading between the lines a bit, but since it is survival of the busiest, if we could do some type of maybe pattern interrupt, right? And
yes.
And replace those, that stinking thinking, so to speak,
yep.
with positive affirming ideas about others and ourselves, et cetera, that can then take root and become that default operating system.
Exactly. And that's what we just need, activation of a competing network in order for the other one, because networks can become unmyelinated. It's use it or lose it. So that myelination can get pruned away and new, but we do need, you know, the consistent presence of a new message
right.
to be exposed to. Yeah.
This podcast is a proud member of the Education Podcast Network, podcasts for educators and podcasts by educators. Listen to all the great education podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com. That's edupodcastnetwork.com.
So I recently asked in a Facebook group called Principal Life. So a bunch of principals. If you're on Facebook, you're a school leader, definitely hop in there. It's awesome because people are just sharing value, answering questions all the time. It's not spammy and it's an awesome place. It's a real forum,
yeah.
which is hard to find. But I recently asked, you know, I was just curious, what are the biggest obstacles that people consistently face, right?
Mm-hmm.
And man, those responses were really interesting. And selfishly, I asked too, because I want to think, how can I serve these guys? You know, because I coach school leaders. All right, give me insight. I want to be able to develop things that are going to help you with your pain
mm-hmm.
points. But one of the things that came through loud and clear is like, all right, I have a staff and they, just like that study, you know, you mentioned mm-hmm. the principal's not saying, okay, we're only looking at the black boys. But for example, I have a mastermind member too, and his hot seat question, I won't give you his name, but mm-hmm. he talked about how he's given the case studies, he's given articles and research, he's mm-hmm. looked at the data of the school. There clearly is a major achievement gap within his mm-hmm. school, and mm-hmm. the staff won't own it. It's like they think it's fake news, quote unquote.
Right.
And so I think it has to do a bit with focus, but that's a pain point for principals.
Yeah.
How do I change that in my staff? And I'm wondering if you have any practical tips that we could get
yeah.
just really applicable for the listeners right now.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. So without, you know, because I usually do like 3-hour workshops, so I'd love to do all of it here. But one of the first things that I think is important for people to understand, okay, there's two things. One is going to be about how adversity affects the brain and like low socioeconomic status, and also something I call micro movement or micro progress. So the first thing is, I'm going to try and sum it up as quickly as I can. So first of all, we do know that low socioeconomic status is correlated with high cortisol levels in the blood.
Mm-hmm.
And high cortisol, when cortisol levels are high, it means that two key areas of the brain are basically, I'm going to just use a kind of a metaphorical term, but I'm going to say offline. And that is the hippocampus and the prefrontal cortex. And the hippocampus is needed to store things in long-term memory and creative sequence. And the prefrontal cortex is needed for executive functioning. Asterisk there, really, really, really important point for people to know is that executive functioning skills are absolutely, irrefutably not something we are born with. We are born with the potential to develop them, but prefrontal cortex, like the executive functioning skills, actually that part of the brain really only fully comes online around the age of 25. And if we do not have a model in our life of prefrontal cortex activity, we will not develop it. And also, if we have a lot of stress or adversity coming from, you know, anything from, you know, just parents being stressed and anxious, to low socioeconomic status, to not knowing where the next meal is coming from, all of that stuff. If that is present, called toxic stress, if there's recurring stress, that can actually severely impair the development of that prefrontal cortex and executive functioning. So, and those are absolutely critical for learning. So that's the first thing. I mean, just being in a low socioeconomic status environment is already going to result in high cortisol, which means that when you're at school, high cortisol means verbal memory completely declines. And that's one of the keys to learning. So that's one thing to be thinking about. The other is, there's also, this is not a lot of people have heard of this theory. It's called the polyvagal theory by Stephen Porges, P-O-R-G-E-S. I'm not going to go into all of it, but a really key piece of it is there's this nerve that as humans, we've evolved, and it's a cranial nerve. It's attached to the cranial, it's from the brainstem, and it goes into the cranial muscles of our head, of face. And when we feel safe, this cranial nerve does a few things. So it expresses our intention towards others, and it lets people know our internal state. When a person feels safe, that cranial nerve tenses the middle ear muscle in order to drown out background noise and tune into a human voice. It's a really specific thing that actually mammals do, but humans specifically do. Listening, when we see people as really, really distracted, a lot of people kind of have this nebulous idea of what that means. But a lot of what it is actually has to do with our ability to tense our middle ear muscle in order to drown out everything else and focus on a human voice. When someone has a lot of stress in their environment, that middle ear muscle doesn't get tensed very often. It's actually very open and relaxed. And what that looks like is a person not listening. It looks like a person who is very distracted and is just simply tuning somebody out or not listening. And what a lot of teachers don't realize is that students who are coming from stressful environments often have that middle ear muscle totally open, and it has not been tensed a lot because they are in such stressful environments on a regular basis that they're not tensing that middle ear muscle. So they get to the classroom and it looks like they're just not listening. And literally they're not, because listening is a muscle movement. It's a motor, it's an actual motor activity that's happening in the middle ear. So one of the key things that I think teachers haven't quite understood well enough is how important it is for the conditions in the classroom to be somewhat safe, for create a feeling of safety for these students. And one of the key things that has to happen in order for this to occur is a sense of connection and trust. And so when there is sincere relationship building between a teacher and the students, it allows them to do that thing that it's a term you used, I'm going to use a different term for it, to decouple. So meaning that generally students are in this, students coming from, you know, stressful environments, and it can be for different reasons, but let's say low socioeconomic status for now, coming from that, when they get to the school, it's hard for them to decouple. It's hard for their brain to decouple that this is a safe environment and the rest of my world isn't. But a teacher can actually inject a feeling of safety in the classroom, and they can do it by, one, using something called the social engagement system, which is their facial expression, the tone of voice, and that's going to come from them feeling calm. So self-care is really important for teachers. They can also do it by creating a sense of play in the class. Any playfulness, any games, humor, anything that creates a feeling of there's play to whatever they're doing, and it does not matter what age. In fact, it's more important the older we get for us to do this. When teachers can introduce that feeling, a feeling of play into the classroom, that can also lower levels of stress for students. So that's one thing that, you know, for leaders to understand is that when there's resistance in staff, what my experience has been in terms of understanding, oh, okay, we're not really treating students differently. They're just acting differently, or, you know, whatever that resistance is coming from. What I find is that a lot of times those teachers have not been presented with really sound, concrete evidence as to what these links between your home environment and how you're going to behave in the school. So they kind of, and the other piece too, I do find, is that we can't put it all on the teachers. It's not just saying that the way a teacher acts towards a student is the end of the line. However, on a more kind of optimistic note, these students are coming in with heavy, what we'll call, some people say, like a heavy backpack of stress coming from their house. Mm-hmm. A teacher can have the opportunity and can create conditions to let them drop that backpack for a second and start fresh in their classroom. And they can do it by creating these conditions of a bit of play, social engagement, connection, trust building. And there's a phrase that I really like from an attachment psychologist named Gordon Neufeld, which is connection before direction. So something that we don't realize is that we are working with incredibly outdated science in our schools. Mm-hmm. And one of the most outdated pieces of the science is behaviorism. Behaviorism is based on punishment and reward systems. And that comes from rat and pigeon studies. And the problem with that is that pigeons, as an extreme example, they don't have a high awareness of their degrees of freedom. And what that means is the more complex a creature gets, the more complex a brain gets, the more it understands that it actually has more options than just one or another. It doesn't Right. have a binary way of looking at the world. And the more complex a creature gets, the less it's going to obey and comply with anything outside of itself, because it already knows it has degrees of freedom. So I'll give you some examples. Like a while ago in like the 70s, this guy said he had this magic formula for dog commands. And if you use this dog command, the dog would obey. So it started to sweep the nation and everyone was going crazy about it. It was this big fad, which I find a lot of things turn into these big fads. But they started to notice that it wasn't happening consistently. And they specifically noticed with German shepherds that they were not all listening to these dog commands. So they started to look a little bit more deeply into this. And they found that the number one predictor, the highest predictor of whether a dog would obey, had nothing to do with the command. It had to do with how attached it was to the trainer. If there was a strong relationship between the trainer and the dog would do whatever the trainer would say. So they dug deeper and deeper into this, and they found that the more intelligent and the more complex a brain gets, the more attachment and connection is important. So they looked at dolphins as an example, are extremely intelligent animals. They see that if a dolphin does not have a relationship with the trainer, is not attached and connected to the trainer, it not only doesn't do what the trainer says, it will often do the opposite of the command. They'll also see with monkeys that if there's no attachment between the trainer and the monkey will not only not do what the trainer says, but often throw their feces at it. So what we see is the more complex we get, and now we're talking about children and they've replicated, you know, similar studies, is that what matters is, does the child, the student, does the person feel connected to the other person? It now becomes more of a question of, they will do what the person is asking because they love the relationship, because they enjoy that person, and not because of compliance or obedience. Compliance and obedience just doesn't work for complex brains. And, you know, we're using that outdated research still.
Oh, it like motivates basically every discipline system ever, you know, in every school.
Yep.
And that was another comment in the same group, Facebook group, was how do I move people from this carrot and stick, you know, punishment
yep.
to more adaptive, more personalized, more humane,
yep.
teaching kids to learn from the choices they make, right? What are the consequences? How does this impact other people? Mm-hmm. But that's not as easy as just writing a detention or suspending a kid for like 3 days.
Exactly.
What's fascinating is, like, you know, from a very high level, every leader that I talk to at some point brings out the idea that relationships are key, you know, and I never know how we're going to get there, but here it is again, in terms of connection.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's juxtaposed with this idea that connection is key. And so all the better leaders, listeners, like, hire Stephanie tomorrow to break it down with your staff, like the science that's going on.
Yeah.
I just found that fascinating. I can't wait to go back and listen.
Yeah.
But despite what you're saying and the complexity of who we are as human beings, we want these very simple solutions. And I don't know if that has to tap into like our need for control or what, but these two ideas are very much at odds with each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
The sense that I just want to be able to kick the kid out of my class and write the detention or whatever.
Yeah.
But unless this kid knows that you really deeply care about them,
yeah.
and you're doing things to create that safety, the
yeah.
calm environment, the playful environment, you know, they're not going to learn at the highest level they can, which is why we exist too, as schools.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious, you know, have you seen anything work well there in terms of bringing the staff from here to there with what we just specifically talked about, like with discipline versus connection?
So two things are coming to mind. One, first of all, and this was a huge aha moment for me at NYU. I took a course on prevention and intervention. And I'd never really heard of the word like used in this term, but and I'm sure most of us have heard of it, is that just that it's the mental preparation and the preparation of conditions is so, so, so much more powerful than any capacity we have to react in the moment. If we don't take the time to mentally prepare our mind for the interactions that are going to come that day, it's really, really hard for our brains, because we are designed to move into fight or flight fairly quickly and be threat detection systems.
So are you talking a bit about then about like visualizing those things we'll be doing? Okay.
Yes, very much. And for that to be part of school culture, for the teachers to engage in practices that allow them to actually visualize how they want to experience their classes before they even set foot in the classroom. And to also, this is another interest, like this is from Gabrielle Oettingen, and she does stuff on kind of how we plan and set goals. The other key piece is that we can't just visualize this, you know, wonderful, perfect, rose-colored vision. In order to actually create change by doing this type of mental preparation, we actually have to envision the person that is giving us a hard time. And this generally has to be as a one-on-one approach first. It's one person at a time, and to notice micro progress with that one person, but to actually picture the worst case scenario with them. So to actually ground ourselves, there's even some different visualizations that teachers can do, but one is, or staff, is to get to this place where someone, you feel calm. And so there's this thing where you can envision yourself actually moving, going up into an elevator, getting out on the top floor. And it's a rooftop garden, and it's exactly how you would love it to be. Everything's beautiful and perfect. And you feel yourself breathing really calmly and feeling really just tranquil and peaceful. But then you go back down the elevator, you get down to the ground floor, and you actually walk into whatever the setting is. And actually athletes do this. This is really, a lot of athletes spend more time visualizing than they do on the actual, you know, platform. Mm. So then they walk back into the classroom, but they see either a group or specifically one at a time, a student that they have a really hard time with. The key here is to actually visualize the worst case scenario, like the terrible, terrible, terrible behavior, and to create, anchor oneself in the feeling that they had on the rooftop, in the presence of that behavior. And the reason for this is, it's not because we don't want to have consequences. See, this is the thing. A lot of people are really scared that if they don't say the get mad, or they don't punish in that moment, that they're somehow letting a person get away with behavior. They're really scared to let that piece go. But what's actually way more important is that, so if someone triggers us and we don't do any of this kind of work for ourselves and they trigger us, that person, first of all, if they are acting in a way that is fight or flight, meaning aggressive in any way, or trying to, you know, escape doing whatever, escape doing work, escape doing, you know, leaving the classroom, if they are engaged in fight or flight, it absolutely 100% means that they are not engaging with you from the area of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, that would allow them to do it on purpose. So there's a really key shift here, which is that whenever we see someone, what we call acting out, we act as though they're doing it to us on purpose. And then that makes us even more mad. And then what happens is it triggers us into going into our own fight or flight system. And the problem with that is, so when I was talking about the social engagement system with this myelinated vagus nerve, so we try to use our voice and our facial gestures and our ears to create a communication between me and another person. When a student is already in fight or flight, it means that they are already kind of stressed out and anxious. And if I respond to that with anger, I will continue the trigger. I will just keep them triggered into their fight or flight. And the amygdala has part to do with this. They call it the amygdala hijack. So I will continue to keep them in the fight or flight state. If, however, I'm able to do some kind of mental preparation where I take some deep breaths and I'm trying to find ways to kind of ground myself in a moment, what I'm doing is I'm activating the prefrontal cortex. I'm activating other parts of the brain so that when I actually get into the classroom and one of those things happens, when they normally would trigger my fight or flight, if I've mentally prepared myself and I've done a bit of this work, I can take some long exhalations as an example and go to, you know, when I've been preparing this in my mind, it helps me activate it more quickly in the moment. Mm-hmm. So when they go into their fight or flight, by not going into my fight or flight and by staying in my zone of my, you know, my frontal cortex, the words that will come out of my mouth are going to be much more, there's going to be a much, much, much higher chance that what I say will be possibly be able to create a new condition in the relationship where they might actually be able to hear me. Now, the other tricky thing though, is that our words don't matter that much. And why is that? So our internal state is the most important thing that we carry into every single interaction we have with every single human being. So when that student is in fight or flight, the parts of their brain that are actually processing language aren't really even online at that moment. So I can talk till I'm blue in the face, but pretty much any word I actually say is really just a puff of air coming out of me, not really entering anything understandable for them. But my internal state actually creates tiny little micro movements in my body. Part of what I didn't even talk about was some of my studies at NYU. I mean, we had electrodes. There's electric, you know, different levels of electricity coming out of our skin. Our sweat smells differently. The tiny little muscles in our throat are tensing at different moments. There's tension in our jaw. And all of this depends on, are we telling the truth? Are we anxious? Are we angry? Are we disgusted? Are we happy? And all of that, all of those tiny little micro signals are being emitted by us at every moment. And without realizing it, all of us are picking up on those signals from other people. So a student, your internal state, when you are in the presence of a staff or a student, that is the most important thing that you can try to have some regulation over. So no matter what you say, your internal state is what matters the most. But to me, this idea of self-regulation, this idea of us trying to have more moments in our day where we try to calm ourselves on purpose and use our mind in ways that are a little bit more on purpose. So that's closing our eyes and trying to just set an intention. There's a word called feelingization instead of visualization, having a feelingization of how we want to feel for that classroom and intentionally preparing that internal state we want to feel while we're in the classroom. That is so much more important really than anything we could say in that moment anyway. And the more adults that are doing that, the more adults are activating those parts of the brain, especially that prefrontal cortex, because it takes a lot of executive functioning to do that. You have to suppress some thoughts, bring up some, you have to be having foresight, you have to be thinking ahead. That's really powerful brain activity that a lot of adults aren't using in the world. If more of us are doing that, what we're doing is we're sending out these micro signals to the people in front of us for them to be able to mirror it back. Because I won't go into all that. There's mirror neurons. There's a whole bunch of processes that happen that have a student, they can actually pick up on every little micro biofeedback signal that we have as our internal state. So the more we get in control of that, the better it is for the people in our relationships and our interactions, like in school. So what I would say to leaders who are trying to get people on board with all of that is what I have seen as being quite successful are mindfulness-based, you know, meditation-based programs, but more for teachers. So a lot of people jump right away to the students and what the students need. And that's important. But in my work now, I really do feel like if the teachers get it, and even if you get a few teachers in your school who are those kind of teacher leaders that are really hungry to learn, if you get even a few of them to really internalize this and to really appreciate the power of this kind of, you know, mental preparation and self-regulation, if they get it, the other teachers start to notice because they see that in kind of the moment-to-moment interaction. So to me, I always feel like it can be more powerful to start with the teachers than jumping right away to the stuff for the students. Because I feel like once the teachers get it, they can like infuse it into their classroom, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm just loving this interview so much. So thank you for being here. I can't wait to, like I said, to listen to it again. And it affirms and confirms a lot of beliefs that I have. We read Search Inside Yourself. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that book in the mastermind, but it's all about mindfulness and how this Google engineer switched to then taking care of Google employees by teaching mindfulness for these very reasons, because they saw people a lot happier, a lot more connected to their peers, connected to the company. They produced better work. You know, just it was a win-win-win-win-win. And this stuff is just so fascinating to me, and why we read it in the mastermind is because, you know, and I asked this question, how do we get our staff to believe this and that kind of thing too. Well, you know what? Stop with that. Don't even worry about influencing your people first, because at what I'm hearing at the core of it, get yourself right. Get your own inner world correct.
Yeah.
And that's going to start being contagious. And then from there too, you can model it, but you can train. Then you could do the, you know, all these different initiatives and strategies or whatever, but take care of yourself first.
Exactly.
And another thing that I want to say is controversial. I'm not a kid's first principal. I'm not a student first principal.
Yeah.
I totally believe that if I would love and take care of my staff like crazy, better than anybody else, then all the kids stuff that I want to happen will happen.
I agree.
But it's because I took care of the adults. And so, yeah, it's important because you said don't jump just to the kids first. And I think like we often overlook our, you know, listen, I'm a little bit on a rant now right now. Better leaders that are listening, like I want you to do a bit of a gut check. And if I was to walk into your school, would I already know that you're going to be loving your kids like crazy. I know this because I know my listeners. Mm-hmm. But if I walked in the building, would I see a culture where you love the staff like crazy? Mm-hmm. I want you to think about that.
Yeah, I very much agree with that. I think that the benefit of that is when a teacher really internalizes this feeling of psychological safety within themselves and knows that they have the power to find that kind of harbor inside themselves in the midst of a storm. When they're able to do that, it gives them a chance to be more authentic when they are trying to explain it to the students. Mm-hmm. So one thing I see is teachers who, so you bring in like a social emotional learning thing into the classroom and you've got teachers teaching it, but students, so there is something that I call the biofeedback of authenticity. I used to work in intelligence actually, and I had to do lie detector tests on, you know, regular intervals. And it's amazing how, and there's some controversy. Some people don't believe that they really measure any of that. For me anyway, it was a mind-blowing experience because he had to test what I was like when I was lying in order to know what my biofeedback would read when I was lying. So he would give me a deck of cards and I had to pick cards. And then he would say, was it this card? And I'd have to say no. And it was interesting because as I said no when I was lying, that was my baseline lie. In my mind, I didn't think anything had changed in me. I thought I was actually a really good liar. And which I thought maybe that's actually a good thing. I wasn't sure. But when he showed me the bio, like the heart rate variability, blood pressure, all this, these different biofeedback measures, and he showed me the screen and it came to my lie, it was off the charts. Mm-hmm. And so what the point of that is that when we are trying to explain something to someone and we don't really even totally believe it ourselves, or we don't get it for ourselves, people will pick up on that because there is physical, these, you know, micro signals that I'm calling it, these micro signals that people will pick up on. And kids are the biggest, most accurate BS detectors on the planet. And one reason is that they don't quite have the same kind of verbal complexity as we do. So they're reading more our signals, our internal state. And so Carol Dweck calls this phenomenon the false growth mindset, which is where teachers are learning about growth mindsets. So I'm not sure how many of you leaders know about growth mindset, but it's this idea that we can all develop our potential. All students can learn to high levels and, you know, our brain changes the more we use it. But anyway, so when some teachers are hearing about this buzzword, they have all the posters, they have all the lingo, they've even gotten the training, but they haven't actually done the work on themselves. And so what we see is that those teachers are using all the, you know, all the high frequency buzzwords and they're talking about it. And they definitely have all the checks on the checklist of they definitely are trained in this. But then when they actually observe in the classrooms, they're noticing that these teachers, the actual moment to moment interactions, not the explicit lessons, but the moment to moment interactions with students are very much fixed mindset. Yep. You can tell that like, you know, just based on their ratings, that teacher is still labeling and they're still having very low expectations of certain students. And they're being much more noticing of certain students over others, you know, for different mistakes and all this kind of stuff. So what happens in those classrooms is the students who have even, you know, done surveys and were rated as growth mindset after they've been in the presence of a false growth mindset teacher, those students start to have fixed mindset behaviors. They stop challenging themselves. They give up very quickly on tasks. They get really, really upset when they make mistakes. And what I'm noticing, the trends that I'm seeing in this whole social emotional learning, but especially growth mindset movement, is that the teachers are feeling and the researchers are noticing that teachers really, really need to internalize this so deeply for themselves before they can even transfer it to students. And one way to internalize the idea that change is possible is for a teacher, an adult, to actually try to change one of their own habits, whether it's a relationship habit, like I always yell at, you know, this person. If that's true, it's important for that teacher to try to figure out, can I create change in my own relationships, even romantic relationships or different habits that I have? If a teacher, and that was my personal journey, was it was stuff I worked on, my own relationship with my father and different people in my life. I did this work. I really intentionally took time every day to visualize and feelingize these relationships and how I could be different. And once I felt the difference, it's like the click happened for me, that total light bulb, aha, like, okay, this is true. This is really, really, really true. And I know it because I experienced myself. And now you can't stop me from talking about it. Like, it's so passionate, it's so authentic when I do it because it's so real for me. And that has been what allowed, because I became a school counselor for many years. And so that was what allowed me, when I was talking to the students, I was able to give them really authentic personal examples of how I did it for myself. And I think that's what would win the students over. So I would say the same for the staff, is that leaders and the staff, once they do some of this work for themselves, they will just have these organic, really natural, really sincere examples to pull from that the students will feel like, oh, this teacher did it too. Like, this teacher, you know, tried to actually change her brain. So, you know, and I feel like that creates a sense of like authenticity between people, instead of the teacher just saying, do this, even though it's clear that that teacher is still getting really stressed out all the time. And actually, just a really important side note on that, I really have to say, is that it's never about modeling perfection. That's a really, really, it's never
progress, not perfection.
It's modeling the falling down and getting up, the modeling the totally getting stressed out and maybe losing it for a second, but figuring out a way to find our cool, because that's human nature. We're not going to be perfect all the time. So it's definitely not modeling it perfection. It's modeling actually accepting our imperfections and our imperfect behaviors, because that's what the kids are going to relate to.
Yeah, so good. The modeling, the getting back down. Yeah. You get knocked down, get back up.
Exactly.
And not, you know, putting perfection on this pedestal. It's totally unrealistic too. People crave authenticity. And last night in the mastermind, Corrine shared a beautiful story of a new teacher to her campus and who wanted her kids to connect with a song that really meant something to them. And by doing so, she shared a song that was really meaningful to her and her family and broke down in tears in front of her students, in front of the principal, in front of actually some pre-service teachers that were observing. And she came and she ran, you know, to the principal. I'm so sorry, you know, for all of this. She's like, what? Stop. That was the most beautiful thing I've seen all day.
Yeah.
And that's because people crave authenticity. Yeah. And that's how you, you know, you really teach, you really model, you really inspire.
Yeah.
Today's show is proudly sponsored by Organized Binder, a program which gives students daily exposure to goal setting, reflective learning, time and task management, study strategies, organization skills, and more. Organized Binder's color-coded system is implemented by the teacher through parallel process with students, helping them create a predictable and dependable classroom routine. You can learn more and improve your students' executive functioning and non-cognitive skills at organizedbinder.com.
Well, Stephanie, listen, thank you so, so much for being a part of the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast today. Do you have any parting words of advice? And what's the best way? People need to get a hold of you. So what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Well, my website. So I'm actually a big promoter of what I call intentional use of technology. So I'm more on LinkedIn than anything else. But my website is, I have a lot of YouTubes up. So definitely you can check those out. It's called mindsetneuroscience.com. And I think, you know, just that last example you gave was such a beautiful reflection of so much of what I teach, which is that sharing our vulnerability is so powerful because we all have that. And she, that teacher, you know, by connecting to something so deeply and showing those feelings and sharing that with other people, she created a sense of that kind of psychological safety that I think a lot of us need to feel in our relationships.
Well, Better Leaders, thank you for investing in yourself today by listening to this podcast. Remember that life is 10% of what happens to you, 90% of how you react to it. Go out there today and be a better leader. Today's podcast is brought to you by Daniel and Stephanie. Be better starting today by heading over to betterleadersbetterschools.com. Type Stephanie in the search bar and the show notes page will pop up. You'll get highlights of today's episode, links to all the resources, and the best way to connect. Stephanie, thanks again for sharing your leadership insights and helping the better leaders be better.
Thank you.
Better leaders, just a few more things before you take off. If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure you subscribe, rate, and review the show. This helps gives the show some social proof, aka iTunes juice, and encourages new people to listen to the show. If you are a social media junkie, share your biggest takeaway from the show, and feel free to tag me on Twitter or Instagram. My handle is Alien Earbud, an anagram for my name, Daniel Bauer. Take the letters, switch them around, and create something interesting and new. That's how I got it. This Sunday is the weekend resource. Do you want to get a short email from me every Sunday where I share the best resources I have come across, links to interesting articles, books, blogs, and podcasts that have challenged my thinking, and a quote that's inspired me and will inspire you as well? If you'd like access to this resource, head over to betterleadersbetterschools.com and join the newsletter at the top of the page. Over 1,000 school leaders subscribe, and I think you'll benefit from it too. In the newsletter, I also share when a new blog or podcast comes out, as well as different opportunities to work with me. Thanks again for listening to the show.